7 years, I think. Nothing told me to ask for a loan, a small loan. She told me that I was not economically viable. How'd your loan ever go? Did they give you a loan? He must be economically viable. There's a man with a smile on his face. He looks like a happy customer. That's what an economically viable person looks like. Economically viable. No.
Welcome to Punkonomics. As you can tell, it is sort of a punk day. And my name is Jesse Velez. I am the host for today's show. Along with me is our Dr. Benny Balick, our resident economist here at Rollins College.
Our doctor.
Our doctor, yeah, Dr. Zinn.
Dr. Zinn.
And today we have a guest, but I'll let Dr. Balick explain what we're doing today.
Right. I think I have you have his number in front of us. I'll remind our audience what's going on. I posted an announcement a little bit earlier today before launching on a afternoon of photo shoot. Oh dear. What can I say? I was the star of a photo shoot this afternoon because they're writing a bio on me for PR materials. Kind of funky. But anyway, so I was a model this afternoon, and now I take that hat off and move back to Punkonomics. And it might not be a cheery show generally, nothing personally against our guest, but his research is about journalistic investigative journalism. Is about a pretty sad topic. He was with us before in June 17th. Talked about his recent articles. I'm showing because I have the number. Got it. We're gonna call him up and hook him up to us. So it's Nicholas Davies. You might hear him call him Sandy because that's what his nickname is, one of his middle names. That was show number 37, and it was about a recent article he wrote on war crimes as policy. He's been doing a lot of research of that for the past at least 10 years and a little bit more. Wrote a book about specifically about the Iraq War. His angle is international law, war crimes, human rights. He's worked with important people in the topic, including International Criminal Court. And all of this material is available on punkonomics.org if you'd like to see it. Sandy is back just recently from Guatemala, which was also a topic of conversation in that show, and I believe actually in other shows. I discussed about how that's the first country that actually convicted a former president for genocide. But things didn't go wonderful. In fact, it was annulled. I'll leave it because I'm going to ask questions about it, so I don't want to spoil the thunder. So let's see if we're adapting here to some new...
Okay, and I think Sandy is on.
We're on. Hey, Sandy.
Yes, hi, Benny. How are you?
I'm fine. How are you? So, as I said, you know, I gave a brief re-bio and told people to go check it out on the previous show, and I posted yesterday also kind of a reminder. So we have with us Nicholas Davies, and I'm guessing Sandy is one of your JS middle names, right? The S?
Yes, exactly. So everybody knows me as Sandy.
Right, that's how you introduced yourself.
Right. And the name I was christened with is sort of, I don't know, it's never really stuck, you know, but no. It is my name, so.
Nick. okay, listen, so I have actually prepared, getting professional slowly but surely. This will be our show 42, I believe, so for all those Hitchhiker Guide to the Universe fans. So a lot of the topics, I have burning questions, and I think I blurted out that you come back from Guatemala. So I'll throw questions at you, and then I'm sure you'll take it where you want to take it, as is our custom. So first of all, well, just a general, you know, well, tell us about your trip to Guatemala.
Well, it was really just a vacation to meet a friend who's a midwife in New Zealand and was going to be in Mexico City. And we'd always told her about Guatemala, so she wanted to go there. So we agreed to go and meet her there. And we didn't do any great exploring of uncharted territory or anything. We just went back to Santiago Atitlan, which is a beautiful place on the shores of Lake Atitlan. And it's the home of the Tzotzil, who are an indigenous tribe who like most indigenous people in Guatemala, have survived 500 years of colonialism and war and most recently, you know, the U.S.-backed dirty war that began with the CIA-backed coup in 1954 and really climaxed in really genocidal campaigns in the 1980s, for which, as you said, the former president has now actually been charged with genocide.
But then, right, I mean,
And they haven't completely... They ruled that part of the proceedings had not gone according to the law, and so they've kind of turned the clock back on the trial. But he is still facing those charges, and hopefully, there will be some kind of justice at the end of it all. But for the people of Santiago Atitlan, they are really doing much, much better. And some of the things that they fought for have been achieved. I mean, before the Civil War, if you go back to the 60s or 70s, the literacy rate in Santiago Atitlan was about 2%. Now, all the children go to school, nearly all the children go to school, and the children are coming out with about a 90% literacy rate.
Employment opportunities and in terms of kind of material standard of living, employment, food.
Yeah, well, they are doing better. I mean, they're doing much better now than the first time we went there 20 years ago, kind of right after the war. As people will tell you, this is what they fought for. Guatemala is still a hugely, hugely unequal society. Most of the good farming land in the country is owned still by, about 10 families who have, essentially ruled the country for hundreds of years.
A traditional model, if you will.
Right. And, and of course that was really, this is still, dealing with the same problems. I mean, it was as a result of a democratic government trying to institute land reform in the early 1950s, that the CIA ended up launching a coup there, which plunged the country into 40 years of civil war.
It's the original banana republic, isn't it?
At least a quarter of a million people.
Yeah, and that's the original story where the term was coined, banana republic, I believe, which, as I know from my Guatemalan ex-student, not a popular term in Guatemala, because obviously.
Right. Right.
Well, you can tell the story both ways.
I mean, yes, it was the, from
Fruit.
The American point of view, it was the bananas that counted in Central America, the bananas and the pineapples and all the other fruit and vegetables and things grown by American companies or by their comprador local elites for export to the United States,
yes.
You know, with very, very cheap or almost slave labor in, you know, throughout the region.
Yeah, the case of the private companies that are harnessing the power of the public military foreign policy in order to forward their interests as opposed to the locals. But you know what you say there is very intriguing, because after all, one of the ironies of this current story with ex-president being convicted of genocide, or in the process of maybe being reconvicted, we'll follow it. Is that the current president is, of course, his ex-assistant, the man deeply involved. So, unlike some of the controversial, popular, more democratic regimes in Latin America, on which we've devoted a lot of time in previous shows, mostly famous Venezuela, and now we have Bolivia and Peru, and to some lesser extent Argentina and Brazil, even with all the problems, etc. A new model of ruling in Latin America. You're saying that Guatemala maintains a very centralized friends of the Washington Consensus, as it is sometimes called, ex-war criminals in power, yet the indigenous population is doing better. So I'm intrigued how that works out. How do they get concessions from regimes like that? Who stopped them from just killing those who are asking for better schooling?
They did.
How?
They did. By fighting and dying in the hundreds of thousands, you know. And, you know, they basically, in the end, President Vicenzo says... Sorrento in the 1990s. Mm. I mean he actually, after a massacre in Santiago, he actually came to the town, you know, officially closed the military base there, got the military out of the community, and you know, that was the point when things started improving for them. And then he you know, in 1996, there was a comprehensive peace deal, you know, between the government and the guerrilla army of the poor. And, you know, and as a result of that, the ruling class and the government were forced into, you know, making some concessions and spending... you know, a little bit more money on, basic public services. Of course, you know, a very basic level of public services, such as people take for granted in many other countries. Having said that, the Guatemala now has a public health system, which the United States does not have. Yeah. So...
that's another can of worms.
But it's still a place of huge poverty, sure. and huge inequality. But you know, by at least, you know, the children getting a basic education, and there being sort of basic infrastructure with you know, things like. I mean, the water is still not fit for the stomachs of people who, you know, who are not used to it. You know, when we go there, we have to be very careful to drink purified water. You know, so it's a mixed bag. But I think
it's one of the poorest countries in the region. It's definitely
yes. So yes, absolutely. I mean, Honduras is still poorer. Obviously, Haiti is still poorer. There is still incredible poverty.
But it's very intriguing. I mean, because again, I mean, just to kind of do the big picture economics here. So we hear about there were some countries where there was democratic and even some radical change, and over the years it's always been thwarted by Western powers, most notably the United States. But we don't hear too much about the cases in which the economic elites rule it very powerfully, very violently, more often than not, over these countries, these poor countries around the world, in Latin America and beyond, and which I have a question later. But you have a situation where the elites, I mean, they could have continued murdering people, but they chose to do differently in some ways, to be rationally capitalistic, to realize that in the long run this was bad for business. I mean, we're not yet in a state of Guatemala in the United States, but sometimes I have very actually positive discussions with children of economic elite here in America, and who say the same thing. I mean, they also think, wait a minute, I mean, how much can we squeeze, you know, when we finish destroying all the unions, when we lower the wages even further, what's the end game? I think you know.
Yeah, well, I mean, it goes back to, you know, what Frederick Douglass said in the 19th century, that, you know, what's the saying? Power does not concede, you know, does not concede anything. You know, that it doesn't have to.
No. Never of their just free good accord, if they're allowed to continue ruling like that, but sufficiently pushed, you do sometimes get a response where, well, we could make some concessions. It'll so, I mean, I suppose also, right, it's better that than an uprising, than a revolution, etc.
Well, I mean, that was a revolution in Guatemala. I mean, you have to realize, when we talk about indigenous people in Guatemala, I mean, they are the majority of the country. Mm. You know, the large majority of the country. So when you had, you know, and I mean, the reason this is referred to as genocide is that, you know, the army, the operations of the army were totally genocidal. I mean, they were wiping out entire villages, and so it was the entire majority indigenous population of the country who were the enemy of the government and the army, and so it evidently did ultimately become unsustainable for the ruling class, and they were really forced to make the concessions that they made. But I think, you know, you can really look at the history of the world in the last few hundred years in a similar way. I mean, you know, we're sitting here now at the end of, well, hopefully close to the end of, you know, 30 years of a certain neoliberal, neoconservative counter-revolution in which...
That has failed on any reasonably measure that we can make.
Social progress that we thought had been achieved and that we thought, you know, had been institutionalized has been gradually dismantled. And, you know, from, you know, the welfare state across Europe and North America. And so I think, especially for young people today, when they look at the direction things are going, I mean, that's the direction they see things going. But if we just take a bit of a longer perspective, you know, and we look at, say, the last two or three hundred years, you know, up until this movement of the last 20 or 30 years, the history of movements like the one in Guatemala is not so uncommon. I mean, we had Gandhi and the Indian National Congress throwing the British out of India. We had the civil rights movement in the 60s in this country. You know, we had the French Revolution, you know, even the American Revolution. We had the Russian Revolution. We had the Chinese Revolution. In fact, there's a very good book by Jonathan Schell, who I think still writes occasionally for The Nation magazine and other publications. Mm-hmm. He's probably getting on in years now. But he wrote a great book, probably back in the 90s, called The Unconquerable World. And he sort of reframed the history of the last few hundred years from that perspective. And I found that quite an inspiring book.
I'll link it.
Because he said, look, time and time again, when ordinary people have actually come together and have actually stood up to the most powerful forces in the world, they have actually won, or they have actually forced concessions, important concessions, from those who seem to have more power than they did.
Let me stop you there for a second, because we have a new sponsor. We have to do a weather, not a weather report, a traffic report now every 20 minutes, I believe. And Jesse just pulled it up. Let's stop in a happy moment there, you know, the FIFA rise and retain power there for a moment. Let's breathe it in and enjoy it, shall we?
Okay. And, the traffic report reads this way. We have an incident on NBSR 429, Sidell Road 2SR 414. Travel time is 19 minutes and it's delay free. Also, another incident, SBSR 417, to Kirby Ford Road. Can I say travel time 13 minutes and it's delay free, believe it or not. Kirkman Road to SR 417. Travel time is 13 minutes and is delay free. Let's say for those of you in Orange County, there is a accident and I guess it has been clear, but you may want to be a little bit careful as well. It is sort of raining out there and roads are slippery. And that's basically it for the traffic report until the next 20 minutes where we have to, announce it again.
Yep. Hopefully nothing too bad. Oh, well, that makes me feel like real radio there for a second. I don't know if that's a good thing or a bad thing, right? Kind of, I do, actually.
Don't make me calm.
Yeah, Jesse's sick, by the way. He's like coming back, we told you last week, he's getting better. Okay, so let me rewind just a tiny bit here, which I think is an important, I think it's an important point to contextualize what Sandy was just saying. So yeah, we know about since the 70s, really late 70s, that we have this rise of conservatism, for lack of a better word, because it's not a good word, but let's just use it now so I don't have to launch into a lecture, right? And Maggie Thatcher, Ronald Reagan, etc. And often, like Sonny was saying, you know, we look at it as the dismantling of the welfare state, and the numbers are strong, you know, in the sense that everything's gone downhill except for private profits of the very wealthy in terms of all the measures of even a capitalist system ever since. We have less innovation, we have less growth, we have more debt, we have, we can go standard of living, public health, infrastructure, investment, saving, everything. So those who were most in the name of markets seem to have performed rather weakly by the numbers over this period of time. And it hasn't been reversed because, you know, Clinton certainly didn't reverse it, though perhaps, you know, I don't know, he was kind of lucky more than anything else, frankly. At least he didn't destroy. Well, he kind of did. Oh, well, another issue. And the current administration is no different either. So this trend continues. But I just want to put out in our commitment to equal opportunity hate, as I like to jokingly call it, that even if you assume the right-wing position, you know, the free market, you know, classical liberalism, what it's called, Adam Smith, if you will, position, it's just as bad. Those last 40 years, the same gentlemen in the name of free markets seem to have dismantled free markets, if anything else. So the story on both sides, the left and the right, the rational left and right, shall we say, coincide pretty well. So, you know, I'll assume the right-wing position here. Less competition, the big government is not necessarily, is part of the problem also, because it supports big business instead of refereeing making them compete. Instead, it actually allows them to escape competition and to take over public funds and taxpayers' money and convert it into private, etc. And recently, like you were saying, it seems that what's going on in America in some ways, like they can't do it in the third world anymore as much as they did, and they're doing it to us. So you see these scary parallels between what used to be done to poor countries around the world being done to the population of the rich world now, too. They don't really need us anymore, in some sense. I'm done with my speech. So maybe just, you know, so in by any criteria, the last 30, 40 years have been a failure. I don't know how to call it anything else, really. But you were telling us, Sandy, about how a successful pressure that eventually forces powerful upper classes, elites who don't seem to have a reason to concede throughout history, eventually they do concede. And I will link this Jonathan Schell book, which I'm not familiar with, to the blog for our interest. Let me ask you a question just to kind of a segue question a little bit. You write about, and do tell us if you're any kind of plans or anything you're working on or anything like that, but you write about very ugly truths. Surely not popular stuff, you know, hard for people to listen to. We read your articles and we find, we're the bad guys. We dropped a couple of times the American foreign intervention in Latin America. It's a horrible story. It's a story of war crime. It's a story of genocide. And while not perhaps always directly pulling the trigger or swinging the machete, we were all there. Our finger is there. I share a similar thing, you know, and I teach in class economic history. You have to tell really uncomfortable, ugly truths about what was going on in history and what continues to go on today. And that brings to this question of facts versus ideologies, I put in my notes, where everything's contested. We live in a postmodern world, but there are some degrees of facts, like the CIA intervention in Latin America and every democratic movement, the genocides, the weapons to people who were murdering civilians. We had excuses for it, but we did it, right?
Mm-hmm.
I'm just thinking about, even in the sense of communication, you know, when you have to deal with that, when that has to come out, and first we have to accept that let's stay with Latin America right now, but afterwards I already have the follow-up question beyond. Right, that we did all this stuff. Every democratic fledgling movement in the world was crushed overwhelmingly by America and its Western European allies, again and again and again. That is a fact. If you want to say that, oh, we had to stop the communists, okay, you know, we could talk about that, but those facts seem to be suppressed or very uncomfortable. People don't like to hear them and prefer not to. Etc. So I know it's kind of not really a question, it's almost a comment, but how do you find them? You publish this really, really ugly stuff. Particularly, I mean, you really talk about war crimes, so it's beyond, it's really, some of your book on Iraq is enough to get you a clinical depression.
Well, I hope not. I mean, I hope that people read what I write and that people find the determination to actually challenge these things, to, you know, because we need to deal with reality, you know, and I think part of the adjustment that those in power have made over these past 30 years is they have got a lot more sophisticated in their use of propaganda. And beginning with the formation of new think tanks and much mm-hmm. greater corporate funding for think tanks beginning in the 1970s.
Smart move.
They understood after seeing, the the mass revolt in the United States against the war in Vietnam, and really, you know, significant move to the left amongst, you know, the baby boom generation, which of course was there, you know, the future of the country at that time. You know, the propaganda has got a lot more sophisticated. And, you know, I think when we look at what's happening today with the Obama administration, it is really quite remarkable. I think that historians will look back on this time, and there will really be a phenomenon here that they will want to study, because you know, essentially in a world where in many ways we all have access to more information than ever before, the United States government today is waging war at least as secretly as it ever did in, you know, in Central America in the 1980s, or, you know, in places like Angola in the 1970s, in, you know, in aiding the Mujahideen in Afghanistan in the 1980s. I mean, today, you know, we have special forces operating in up to 120 countries every year, about 70 countries at any given time. Now, and these operations, some of these are, you know, training operations and things like that you can read about in the newspaper. But many of them are completely secret operations. You know, the operations of JSOC, the Joint Special Operations Command, are legally, formally, officially secret. You know, where we're not allowed by law to know what they are doing in our name in all these other countries. So on the one hand, you've got that going on. And then on the other hand, you have this incredible image-making, branding machinery around, you know, Barack Obama, the Obama administration, the Democratic Party, you know, to portray all of them as the good guys here, the ones who are actually, you know, trying to, you know, to stop the mean Republicans in Congress, and
it's so effective.
And it has been largely successful. I mean, it's an astonishing fact, but in the presidential election last November, you know, just what is that, 8 months ago, even as all this was going on, you know, I mean, obviously the Republicans had completely discredited themselves in 8 years of power there. We'd had 4 years to, you know, to actually come to grips with the reality of what the Obama administration is actually doing, you know, behind all the rhetoric and imagery and, you know, Shepard Fairey iconic pictures of Obama and all of that. And yet, you know, what percentage of American voters went out and actually voted for somebody else in the presidential election?
Yeah.
It was actually less than 1% nationwide. I mean, if you treat Obama and Romney as essentially, you know, part of the same system or regime, they got 99%. Yeah. I mean, you know, that's more than Erich Honecker in East Germany, you know, in the 1990s. And so you know, this propaganda system is so effective that it actually manages to march 99% of American voters. I mean, you know, that's of course leaving out 40% who've given up on voting altogether. But
frankly,
those
it's pretty
who
rational.
Do vote.
Was it Mark Twain that said, "Don't vote; it only encourages the scoundrels"? I think it was.
Yeah, and I mean, and we have to realize too that I mean, yes, you know, we're talking now in Florida, and you know, we understand that in Florida, some people, you know, people might have had a legitimate fear. You know, one evil was played off against the other, and well, if we don't vote for Obama, then Romney will get elected, or vice versa.
Yeah, on the small, not small.
That only works in about six states, you know, or maybe 10. I mean, and yet that 99% success rate of keeping people within the two-party system also, you know, it works. In California, it works in New York, it works in Texas, it works in Alabama, Mississippi, places where the outcome of the presidential election was never in doubt. So I think there's an understanding here that what we are up against and why there and one of the reasons why there is so little, you know, open dissent and open, you know, revolt in, or people power in this country is that this propaganda system has been very, very effective.
Yeah, and it's remarkable indeed. I mean, not that there was much, and people rationally in the small scale rationality, of course, people are. It's understandable. So you know, I can see why a lot of women would say, "Well, I know I'm holding my nose, but I gotta vote Obama because of reproductive rights," or anybody who's not Lily White.
Why would you feel like that living in a state like New York or California or somewhere where you know where Romney was a foregone conclusion, like Texas or Mississippi.
Right. You know, why not a third-party candidate if you even know that they exist?
It's not rational. It gets people at a level that is beyond reason.
Yeah, alignment, like a religion, really, almost. Alignment to a cult. If you don't want to be associated with these guys, so you have to be associated with the other guys. And you can't break out of the mold. That's so, of course. Yeah, like I like your comparison very much to the fact that, so I want to underline it, the fact that the two parties are quasi-identical with a few, and I don't want to be disrespectful, of course, yeah, I mean, the fact that Democrats are somewhat more open to gay rights, it's important to gay people, I get it, you know, but I don't want to belittle that, but it's one specific issue. And with those slight divisions, then they can, you know, okay, you guys get the religious fundamentalists, we get the gays and brown-skinned people, and between us, we pretty much enact certainly the same foreign policy and the same economic policy with hardly any distinction whatsoever for many, many years to the detriment of the vast majority of the population. So your comparison with East Germany of basically a one-party system. But people are maybe a little bit waking up to it.
I think this discussion often gets framed that way, but that's not really what I'm saying. I'm not saying that, oh, the Democrats are the same as the Republicans. What I'm saying is that for most of the population, they know very well going into the election that their vote is not going to actually make a difference in who becomes president. And so they have the opportunity to use their vote in a way that can actually express what they really believe would be the right course for the country. And there are, you know, in every election, alternative candidates. There was, you know, Jill Stein for the Green Party. There was Rocky Anderson, the former Democratic mayor of Salt Lake City, and he, you know, if you went to his website, he had very well thought out positions on just about everything.
But you don't see these people except in the alternative press.
That is where we come back to the propaganda system.
Yeah, since Ross Perot in the 80s, they shut the back door completely.
Right, but of course he did have access to the propaganda system because he was an establishment candidate, he was very welcome to go on the corporate news shows.
But he was eventually considered a threat to Republicans as a possible splitter, right?
I talked to so many people who are basically, pretty disgusted with the Republicans and the Democrats. And yet, I think that, if you look at that election result, the conclusion is that, the brainwashing is working. The propaganda is working when it counts, one of the things people do have is that opportunity to go out and vote every couple of years. That is what the establishment uses to validate their power. And yet when that time comes, People do what is expected of them.
Okay, I think we have. Hey, Jesse, I think you have to tell us about the traffic, and I have a follow up question there already. All righty, anything changed there?
No, so far it looks like the delay time has increased. That let's see, Ivanhoe Boulevard to SR 408, 9 minutes to Universal Boulevard. And that would be approaching the SR 535. You have about 41 minutes. So basically, it's a parking lot. Let's see. Incident at NBSR 429, Sedell Road to SR 414. You're still looking at about 19 minutes. It seems to be delay free. Same with SR 417. SR 434 to Curryford Road is also delay free, and SR 408 Kirkman Road to SR 417 is also delay free. Looking about 13 minutes travel time, and that's it.
It's not bad for a quarter to five. Okay, jumping right back in. So Sandy, you're saying to the people that vote your conscience, as they say. Your vote is not wasted after all. It doesn't, you should actually, that would make your voice count more. If you're a real liberal, if you will, then vote green. If you're a real conservative, if you will, then vote libertarian. So, and right? I mean, that's kind of a little bit...
I guess it's okay to vote sort of tactically if there is some tactics involved, but in most cases there isn't,
Like in the key
but
states.
I think more importantly, this tells us something about the system that we're living in. And in the last time I was on, I started to talk at the end of the show, and we seem to be doing the same thing now, but about an article I wrote for Z Magazine in May 2012. You can look this up online on the Z Magazine website on May 2012. And the article was titled "Investing in Weapons, War, and Obama." And I'm in the process now of working on a kind of follow-up article to that. Mm-hmm. And essentially, the question I'm trying to answer, Jimmy Carter, former President Jimmy Carter, has defined the American political system as a system of legalized bribery based on campaign contributions from wealthy Americans, and then which then pays for slick marketing of candidates to serve the interests of the aforementioned campaign contributors. And what I'm trying to do is to examine how this political system, which, you know, I sort of regard as the actually existing political system of the United States, it's obvious how this leads to the ever-expanding plutocracy that we have. Mm-hmm. But what's perhaps not quite so clear is how this system actually leads to ever-expanding militarism and war crimes.
Mm-hmm.
And in the article, the first article, I explored the relationship of Barack Obama to the Crown family of Chicago, who have been his longtime benefactors and supporters and campaign contributors. He was introduced to Lester Crown, who was then the CEO of General Dynamics, one of the largest weapons manufacturers in the world, when Barack Obama was a 27-year-old intern at a law firm in Chicago. And, you know, they have really, as much as anyone else that I'm aware of, really bankrolled Obama's rise to power. And so, of course, this then, of course, raises some very obvious questions, I contrast in the article, you know,
which I pulled
way,
up already, by the way, for the audience, and will link on punkonomics.org.
Yeah, I contrast the way this family, you know, vetted Obama in the course of a 20-year close personal relationship with, you know, the way the rest of us were introduced to Barack Obama as, you know, this wonderful iconic character on our TV sets. And, you know, and there's a very obvious question, which is, well, you know, who do you think actually knows Barack Obama better, you know, Lester Crown or you? And it, you know, there really is, that's a rhetorical question, of course. You know, and then, you know, in the article, I go into how Barack Obama's policies have actually benefited General Dynamics, you know, based on going through their annual report for a few years and some other things. But, you know, we really have to question how. I think this is just basic understanding that people need about how our political system actually works. You know.
Yeah, and I understand there was a Pew Research survey recently that showed that generally the public is no longer interested in campaign finance reform. I mean, granted that it's often just a slogan being used by politicians who have no intention of doing anything about it, but the shock, to me, that is the core problem. That is, if there's one, number one, that's it. It goes even before empire or anything like that, because, like you point out, it's part of what maintains all the things that really most of us who are not on the payroll should agree, whatever ideology is that is not working for us. Yet the public doesn't seem to be concerned. I mean, that links to what you were saying about how people don't even realize they're third parties, don't really realize they can get off that kind of Punch and Judy game of politics that we play. But some people are. I mean, I'd like to, you know, Lawrence Lessig, the legal expert, has been calling for that. I want to ask you something quite specific. It's been my pet idea. I probably have already in person when we sometimes meet when you come visit the department. But in kind of in continuation to what to do about it like that, it seems always a little bit difficult to think, given all the power that is already concentrated economically and thus politically, that there's little chance of getting electoral result sufficiently powerful to put, and again, to be neutral, either green if you're lefty or libertarian if you're righty, in power. Should there not be an alliance between, you know, socialists, let's use the S word, and libertarians or anarchists? It's not such a... is there a chance for that, that idea, you know, of a non-ideological party of breaking this down?
On the anti-war issues, there is. I mean, I was at a meeting last night with my friend Patrick McCann, who's the national president of Veterans for Peace.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, one of the other people at the meeting was my friend Robert Noval, who is a prominent libertarian here in Miami.
But running for office, a ticket, a new party.
Well,
that can take some degree of power, that can form a challenge.
Well, I think that, you know, while we agree on some issues, you know, I think that's problematic in terms of electoral politics. You know, I mean, I work with PDA, which is Progressive Democrats of America, and we work with the Congressional Progressive Caucus in Congress, which was founded by Bernie Sanders, but of whom all the members except for Bernie are in fact Democrats. But they are, you know, the leadership of the Progressive Caucus is, you know, the really the strongest, most progressive members of Congress, which are Raul Grijalva, Barbara Lee, John Conyers, Keith Ellison, and people like that. And, you know, I mean, they are fighting, you know, for the things that we're talking about here.
They're not getting much. I mean, with all many respect that I have for their fight, they seem to be thwarted by their own party again and again. The same goes, by the way, for right-wingers that are kind of, let's say, true libertarians, not on the take. They also get thwarted by their own party.
Right. Well, I think it's, you know, I think it is a difficult choice. I mean, I have many friends, you know, who are members of the Green Party, and so I think it's in a way a matter of sort of personal, you know, where each of us decides to put our energy. But I mean, for instance, you know, I've just been working on a PDA national email blast that's going out first thing tomorrow morning, titled Support Food Stamps, Not Bombs. And this is basically calling on, you know, 100,000 PDA members around the country to call their member of Congress and ask them to vote no on the National Defense Appropriation Bill, which is coming up for a vote sometime this week or next. And, you know, when the first part of that process, the NDAA, came up in June, you know, 108 members of Congress actually voted no, you know, to fund the Pentagon for the next year. That's less than a quarter of the members of Congress. But, you know, it was almost half of the Democrats in Congress. 90 Democrats voted no on the NDAA. We hope to have more on the appropriation bill this week or next. And so, you know, it's, The good guys are always, at least at this point, in a minority within the Democratic Party, within Congress. But that does not mean that, you know, they're not there.
So I think from
a tactical or strategic point of view, I think both things are important. I think it is important to build the Green Party and other alternative parties, but I think it is also important to still be interacting with the people who hold power today, to be calling up our members of Congress and telling them what we think about all this.
The thing is that are rolling back to the...
Because ultimately, members of Congress, like the government in Guatemala, okay, ultimately are susceptible to pressure when there is enough of it. And, you know, we only have to look at the success of groups like the NRA and AIPAC to see how movements that certainly do not represent the majority of of Americans have managed to, in effect, wield a kind of majority power that, that's really not representative. And if people of conscience, you know, give up on the inside part of American part, completely give up on the inside part of American politics and do not call their members of Congress about the things they care about, then essentially we're ceding the field for the foreseeable future to the bad guys, basically.
I think it's
important to keep doing those things. I'm not saying that in and of themselves they are a complete answer to the situation we're in by any means. I think all the outside organizing is very important too. But I just don't think that, you know, I think we need to use all the tools at our disposal, and that is one of them.
I think, you know, we're almost out of time, and I got to say, first of all, that, you know, if you're up to it, we can have a monthly show as far as I'm concerned. There's so much more to talk about, and I'll definitely coordinate with you maybe in the near future to go on other things, and then can't wait to see your update on this article, and I'll post everything to Pukonomics.org. Let me, you know, we are at a time, so I'll just say that the multi-pronged approach, I mean, that has a long tradition in political theory and action, to work with multiple, from the inside, from the outside, in parallel, sideways, etc., in the hope that something works. When you look at historically, actually, that's kind of how they worked. Often big changes, revolution, if you will, fail precisely because one dominant way of doing things dominates and crushes the others, and then it goes badly wrong. So this pluralism, I think, is a good place to stop. And I want to thank you very much, Sandy, for talking with us. And I look forward to doing this again.
Yeah, thank you, Benny.
thank you, Sandy.
All righty.
Thank you, Sandy.
Bye-bye. Thanks. We are out of time.
Yep, we're out of time. All right, folks, you've been listening to Punkonomics with Dr. Benny Balick.
Bye.
The preceding program did not reflect the views or opinions of the station, its management, or employees.